This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
وَهُوَ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the Israeli military conducts fresh attacks on the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian death toll rises to 115, among them 27 children and 11 women. Argentinians take to the streets of Buenos Aires in solidarity with Palestinians as Israel intensifies attacks on the Gaza Strip. Also ahead, thousands of Greek workers take to the streets in Athens to protest against the planned government labor reforms. Thank you for joining us. Now, the Israeli military continues to pound areas across the Gaza Strip with airstrikes and artillery fire. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the death toll from Israeli attacks on the coastal enclave has reached at least 115. Since the strikes began on Monday, 27 children and 11 women have been killed in Gaza. Over 620 others have been wounded. In a new Israeli raid on a house in the east of the city of Rafah, six members of a single family were killed. Hundreds of Gazans are fleeing from the east and north of the besieged enclave, fearing the regime's raids. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has conducted rocket and drone attacks into Israel in response to the regime's continued strikes, which killed several of its top commanders and dozens of civilians. The movement used a new indigenously produced drone named Shahab to target Israeli troops near the Gaza Strip. Hamas said it also fired a new missile at Ramon Airport in southern Israel, some 220 kilometers from the coastal strip. The Israeli military says over 1,700 rockets have been fired from the besieged territory since Monday. According to Israeli medics, seven people have been killed in the attacks. Meanwhile, Hamas has said that the movement's strategy towards the Israeli regime has changed from defense to offense. A spokesman for the military's wing also said there are no red lines when it comes to responding to the Israeli enemy.
If it comes to responding to aggression and claiming victory for our people and our sanctities, there are no red lines, sacred rules of engagement, or complicated calculations.
Abu Ubaida warned Israel against the continuation of aggression, saying it is easier for Hamas to target Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities than drinking water. The spokesman said the group has launched the largest missile strikes against Israel since the 1948 occupation of Palestine. He said every price that the Palestinian resistance pays is a sacrifice for Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. Abu Ubaidah said, "What distinguishes this battle is the solidarity of the Palestinian people and their unity on the option of resistance." Political commentator Ramzi Barood says the Israeli Prime Minister did not expect that the resistance movement in Gaza would come to defend occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds with such a determination. Here he is.
Netanyahu actually did not intend initially to go to war against Gaza. And there are two proofs of that. Number one, he wanted to instigate a crisis in Sheikh Jarrah in order for him to humiliate the Palestinians in front of cameras and the media, and to rally the crazies, the right-wing Jewish extremist constituency behind him in order for him to gain few political points in the run-up possibly of a fifth elections, or at least to force the other parties to accept a compromise and an emergency government. What he did not anticipate, two things. Number one is that Gaza would actually come to Jerusalem's rescue with such ferocity and such determination. Number two, he did not anticipate that all Palestinians everywhere in Palestine, from Al-Quds to Gaza, to the West Bank, and of course, to Palestinian communities inside today's Israel, Al-Lud, Al-Ramla, Umm al-Fahm, and elsewhere. They are all rising in unison, beyond factional lines, beyond ideological lines, beyond religious lines. To the contrary, they are finding that common ground, and they are finally creating that coveted Palestinian unity, not through Hamas and Fatah, but through the Palestinian people themselves.
Now, Argentinians have taken to the streets of the capital, Buenos Aires, to express solidarity with Palestinians as Israel intensifies attacks on the Gaza Strip. Protesters waved Palestinian flags as they gathered near the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires. They called for a stop to what they described as the Zionist aggression in Palestine. The protesters chanted, "Longer live the Third Intifada." That's the term used for the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli oppression. People in Buenos Aires also urged the Israelis to get out of Gaza and said the regime is massacring Palestinians.
This protest is not unique. In hundreds of places across the world, there are thousands and thousands taking up the cause of a people under assault, of a people that the press say is war of equals. That does not exist. One of the most powerful armies in the world, the Israeli army, is massacring Palestinians. Their weapons are their dignity. Their arms are to win popular opinions in the streets, and that is what we are doing, solidarity.
The Buenos Aires rally was part of global protests in support of Palestinians in Gaza. Such demonstrations took place in different cities, from Chicago in the US to Nairobi in Kenya, as well as Beirut in Lebanon. People worldwide also expressed support for the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, where Israel has intensified its crackdown in recent days and weeks. At the same time, some countries, including France and Germany, have warned citizens against holding pro-Palestine rallies. Both states have cited possible violence during the rallies. Elsewhere, Yemenis have held the Eid al-Fitr prayers in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to condemn the continued silence of the international community towards the Israeli blockade on their country. Our correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
After the Eid al-Fitr prayers, Yemenis came together outside the UN office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to restate the demands of the international community to take real measures against the Saudi blockade on Yemen.
Yemenis celebrate Eid al-Fitr this year amid the continued aggression and blockade, and the sufferings of Yemenis are increasing due to the continued detention of fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has caused a severe fuel crisis. We regret to see the United Nations and the international community silent towards our suffering.
Protesters slammed Saudi Arabia for its continued detention of oil vessels that has left their country in a desperate struggle to survive amid the harsh shortage of fuel. They said Riyadh has to release their tankers to prove its good intentions for moving towards a political solution.
لا زالت أعمال القرصنة مستمرة عرض البحر من قبل قوات حلف العدوان بقيادة
Piracy acts against Yemeni oil ships are continuing under the leadership of the United States with the participation of the United Nations. We are about to reach the end of the May and the Saudi coalition has only allowed one ship to enter the country since the beginning of 2021. The United Nations bears full responsibility for the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since the beginning of the war in March 2015, depriving millions of Yemenis of their basic needs. The United Nations described the situation in the war-torn country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Yemenis believe that the United Nations bears responsibility for their suffering as it provides the political cover-up for Riyadh and its allies. They say the international community must break its silence and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege from their country.
Now, the United Nations Security Council is set to hold a public session on Sunday to discuss tensions between Israel and the Palestinians. The world body was initially supposed to hold the session on Friday, but the U.S. objected to the plan, and that led to the delay. Washington had asked for postponing the meeting until Tuesday. Diplomats now say they have reached a compromise over U.S. objections, and the session will be held on Sunday. The hostilities between Israel and the Palestinians entered their fifth day on Friday with no sign of abating, despite international calls for de-escalation. The International Criminal Court says it will carry out investigations into alleged war crimes in Palestinian territories, even if Israel refrains from cooperation.
I said that these are events that we're looking at very seriously. We are monitoring also very closely. And I remind that investigations have opened, and this the evolution of these events could be something that we will also look at in the course of our investigations. I think this is just to alert people to be not to escalate.
The ICC's prosecutor Fatou Bensouda confirmed that she is following the current escalation of violence in the occupied territories for possible war crimes. She rejected allegations by Israel and the United States that her office is biased against Israel. Tel Aviv and Washington have objected to the ICC's jurisdiction and rejected membership in it. The ICC is investigating the Israeli regime's war crimes during the 2014 Gaza War after nearly 5 years of preliminary inquiries. Over 2,100 Palestinians were killed in the seven-week Gaza War back then. In other news, thousands of people take to the streets in the Greek capital to express their opposition to a controversial new labor law. Demonstrators from the Greek Labor Union rallied outside the parliament in central Athens against reforms that Greece's conservative government outlined on Wednesday. The country's labor minister says changes to laws that date back decades offer more freedom to decide working hours and help tackle exploitation, unpaid overtime, and undeclared work, which have fueled a large untaxed grey economy. Now, the opponents, however, maintain that the government's plans will undermine workers' rights and freedoms. The most contentious part of the bill introduces flexibility to the 8-hour work day. Italian authorities are alarmed by the increasing number of asylum seekers arriving to the island of Lampedusa. Rome is calling on EU partners to share the flows more, but no specific pledge has been made by any member state so far. Max Cividi reports from Rome.
After a relatively quiet time on the Lampedusa island, with only a few migrant boat landings per day recorded last year, the number of asylum seekers arriving by sea in Italy has started to pick up again over the past months, to the point that Italian authorities are alarmed by developments in the area. Around 13,000 people seeking asylum have arrived in Lampedusa by sea since the start of 2021, up from about 4,000 in the same period last year.
The real issue here is not the number of migrants arriving in Italy, Malta, Spain and Greece, which is still relatively low compared to previous years, but rather the contribution one expects from all other EU member states in terms of solidarity. Lampedusa doesn't have the health facilities to provide assistance to thousands of migrants in this pandemic crisis.
Over 2,000 migrants landed on the Italian island of Lampedusa between Sunday and Monday. Following the arrivals, the European Union's Home Affairs Commissioner called on member states to show solidarity with Italy and support the relocation of migrants. However, a European Commission spokesperson has said that despite contacts with several member states, no specific pledge has been received so far.
At an ongoing conference organized by the Portuguese duty presidency of the EU in Lisbon, Italian Interior Minister Luciana Lamorgese has called on Brussels to find a long-term structural solution on how to manage asylum seekers. The minister has urged the activation of concrete, solid solidarity mechanisms, as well as a shared strategy to counter the smuggling of human beings and illegal immigration.
This is the other question of Lamorgese said also, humanitarian evacuation from Libya. They have already started, but again, it is dependent on the willingness of states to say, okay, I take 5,000 people from Libya.
According to Italian intelligence sources, there is an estimated 900,000 migrants in Libya kept in appalling living conditions in detention centers where abuse and torture are rife. About 1,000 people trying to reach Europe by sea have been returned to the North African country since the start of May. Max Civili, Rome.
Armenia has launched a criminal case against Azerbaijan after accusing the country's forces of violating its territorial integrity. The Armenian Defense Ministry said Azeri armed forces on Thursday carried out a provocation against the country's sovereign territory in a bid to ensure positional advance into border areas. The ministry said the Armenian side stopped the Azeri advance and forced the troops to return to their positions. Azerbaijan rejected the accusation, saying it was enforcing its own border and is committed to easing tensions in the region. The two sides are at odds after the recent deadly clashes over the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. The conflict resulted in territorial gains for Azerbaijan and was eventually brought to a halt by a Russian brokered ceasefire. Presidential election is underway with more contenders entering to heat up the battle. Noman Abedi has attended the third day of signing up.
Scores of people have registered to take part in the 13th Iranian presidential election. On the third day, some reformist hopefuls turned up at the election office of the Interior Ministry. Former parliament members Ali Mutahari and Mahmoud Sadeghi presented their plans to the reporters.
Everyone, even the anti-establishment people, the supporters of the previous regime, and even the BBC reporters must be allowed to talk. Our red line is to create chaos, but making a speech is absolutely free.
I want to be the voice of the people based on the experience I gained from representing the people in the parliament, as well as relying on my profession, which is advocacy.
Mohsen Mehralizadeh was another hopeful who gave his credentials to the Interior Ministry to send his name to the Constitutional Council for final approval. He has served as governor and minister in different cabinets.
Social, cultural, and economic factors all affect the consciousness of society. If we can solve the economic problem in this country, the situation will improve. Economy is a priority of the country today, and if we pay attention to the economy and people are freed from this poverty, unemployment and related problems, vitality will return to society as a result.
Ramin Mehmanparast, former Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, also announced his bid to contend for the post. On the first 2 days, men with military backgrounds, including Mohammad Hassan Nami, ex-defense minister Hossein Dehghan, and the IRGC commander Saeed Mohammad also signed up to run. The other ones who showed up were former Petroleum Minister Rostam Qasemi, ex-Sports Minister Mohammad Abbasi, current Deputy Parliament Speaker Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, and also some other previous parliamentarians. 2 days left until the end of the deadline to register for presidential elections, and some high-profile figures have not shown up yet. We have to wait and see that who are the final contenders to run Humana with the Tehran.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
The British Prime Minister's silence on Israeli regime's latest assault against Palestinians in the occupied city and in the Gaza Strip is inexcusable, says Peter Bourne, writer, in an article titled Al-Aqsa Attack. Boris Johnson's silence over Israeli regime violence is a disgrace. Stay tuned for the details, please. It's been less than a week since British Prime Minister Boris Johnson ordered two patrol vessels to the Channel Islands port of St. Helier in an escalation of tensions with France. Amid front-page banner headlines and media fanfare, government sources accused Paris of sinking Lord and Jersey's Nazi occupiers during the Second World War. According to a government source quoted by The Telegraph, at least when the Germans invaded, they kept the lights on. Welcome to what passes for foreign policy in Johnson's Britain. Compare and contrast this with the British Prime Minister's reaction to the terrible events in Al-Quds over the past few days. The Israeli regime forces, firing rubber-coated metal bullets and dispensing tear gas, invaded Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of the most sacred sites in Islam. Yet, the British Prime Minister had nothing to say. We have witnessed terrible scenes of Israeli regime police brutality, silence from the British Prime Minister. Overnight, at least 25 dead in Gaza, including 9 children. More silence. Horrifying scenes of racist chanting against Palestinians by Israelis at the Western Wall. Just silence. Admittedly, it's been a busy few days for Johnson in the wake of British elections, but election pressures did not stop Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon from issuing a statement recently that attacking Al-Aqsa was utterly indefensible and a violation of international law. Labour leader Keir Starmer, better late than never, added his voice. He said, "The violence against worshippers during Ramadan at the Al-Aqsa Mosque was shocking," he tweeted.
The Zionist regime must respect international law. Still nothing from Boris Johnson. We are witnessing what could become the most dangerous crisis in the West Asia-North Africa region for years, yet there has been no serious response from the Johnson government and, inexcusably, nothing from the Prime Minister himself. Britain remains a member of the UN Security Council, while only 2 months ago, Johnson published his Integrated Defense and Security Strategy, which claimed to set out a vision for a global Britain. It asserted the British dedication to the values of democracy and a commitment to universal human rights, the rule of law, freedom of speech, and faith and equality. To the point of tedium, the British Foreign Office reiterates its dedication to global human rights. But remember this, Britain did more than any other country to bring into existence the regime of Israel. The Balfour Declaration in 1917 not only promised to deliver a homeland for the Jews, but also pledged that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. After a week of Israeli regime police brutality in which Al-Aqsa Mosque has been raided 3 times, that promise lies in ruins. Why the silence? Part of the answer lies in the yawning gap that has opened up between British Foreign Office advice and Tory government policy. Philip Hall, the British Consul General in Al-Quds, is well aware of and condemns the demolitions and forced evictions in occupied East Al-Quds, which are the root cause of the weekend's horrific events. Indeed, the consulate published a video showing Hall speaking to residents in Sheikh Jarrah. The UK position on this is clear, Hall said. East Al-Quds is occupied and it's been illegally annexed. The restitution and planning laws here and their implementation are unfair, and they breach Israel's obligations as an occupying power. Yet Rob has unforgivably failed to spell this out. We're not talking, as Israel disingenuously claims, of a real estate dispute. We are talking about forcible evictions are part of a state-sanctioned policy to change the demographic character of occupied East Jerusalem, which includes settlements and demolitions. It is not a tedious real estate dispute, but a struggle for a future Palestinian presence in the city. Rob shamefully waited until the Hamas reprisals before making a statement, and then he confined himself to a feeble call for both sides to de-escalate. The Tories have not always been afraid to criticize the Israeli regime. In 2006, William Hague, then the shadow foreign secretary, used the term disproportionate about the Israeli regime invasion of Lebanon. His remarks were followed by protests and an alleged threat to withdraw Tory funding from Lord Combs, an important donor and member of Conservative Friends of Israel. To the best of knowledge, no senior Tory has ever used that phrase again. It is time they did. Disproportionate is not a strong enough word to describe the Zionist regime actions in recent days. But it's time for the British Prime Minister to speak out loudly against the moral horrors of Israeli regime policy in occupied East Al-Quds and beyond, and not just to urge justice for beleaguered Palestinians.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Confrontations continue in Al-Quds as Israeli occupation forces stormed the squares of Al-Aqsa Mosque while the worshippers were attending prayers during Ramadan, fired rubber bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades, and arrested a number of Palestinian natives who responded fearlessly. At a time when the Palestinians were awaiting the date the illegal colonial settlers set to storm Al-Aqsa Mosque days before Eid al-Fitr, the occupation forces preceded the settlers by storming the mosque, attacking worshippers, and closing Al-Aqsa Mosque completely. The world watched in real time via social media the escalatory step, the largest in years, that triggered condemnation of all resistance factions who told the occupation to await the resistance response at any moment. The Israeli attack continued for hours, where worshippers were arrested as the violence even reached the call to prayer room and the loudspeaker wires were cut off. This comes as tensions rises in the occupied Al-Quds over the issue of the Sheikh al-Jarrah neighborhood, which has turned into a daily clash with the Israeli occupation in an attempt by the Palestinians to protect the neighborhood's residents from the risk of illegal eviction. Over the past week, Al-Quds went through harsh hours, interspersed with the violent clashes with the occupation, which allowed illegal colonial settlers in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to attack an iftar table prepared by Palestinians in front of homes threatened with eviction. To add salt to the injury, leader of the religious Zionism party, Yair Ben Ghafir, installed a tent office for him in the neighborhood, which was enough to blow up the situation and push the fasting Palestinian natives to break the tent. The occupation forces then arrested dozens of Jerusalemites and wounded many others, while the media monitored settlers carrying machine guns and pistols, directing them towards unarmed Palestinians to terrorize them. What's to give in all of this injustice as the world watches live Israel's incremental genocide against the native Palestinians? Armed resistance and liberation. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
Native Palestinians carried on with their solidarity protests against forced displacement of families from the occupied East Al-Quds as Israeli occupation forces continued to raid the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied city, spraying skunk water, which is literally a chemically enhanced type of sewage water, and physically assaulting Palestinian residents and solidarity protesters. Now, these protests intensified, reaching Al-Aqsa Mosque, where hundreds of Palestinians were wounded in confrontations with the occupation forces at one of Islam's holiest shrines and also in other parts of the city. To discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Jay Carapel, political writer and commentator. Thank you for being with us, Jay. Now, the same Israeli accord that has ruled that another seven native Palestinian families are going to lose their homes in Sheikh Jarrah, they are supposed to leave their homes before August 1st for illegal colonial settlers to bring their stuff in and just sit inside of the Palestinian homes. I've never seen a court order that rules with such blatant hypocrisy, unless it is obviously from inside the occupied Palestinian territories with the Israeli regime. The Judaization of Al-Quds, what we are seeing today, is happening right under the nose of the UN and what is called the international community. This has been going on for 73 years, Jay. What makes this one any different?
There's really no difference. Everything's just gotten worse for the Palestinians, unfortunately. And ever since Trump recognized, from the American perspective, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, that was back in December 2017, all of the various Israeli settler organizations have been emboldened, and they've been encouraged to push harder for the ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem. So you mentioned the UN. I mean, in the past, the United States and other Western governments, they were more hesitant to legitimize Israeli control over East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and that's because those territories are illegally occupied according to international law, meaning that any settlements built in these territories are also illegal, as far as the UN is concerned. So today, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled to defer the decision on the eviction of the seven families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah by August the 1st, as you mentioned, most likely because it's generating bad publicity, especially when you look at the facts of the case. Back in 1982, when the Palestinian families of Sheikh Jarrah were being threatened with eviction, they were betrayed by their Israeli lawyer who signed over their land without even telling them. This turned them into protected tenants, which meant that they would have to pay rent to an Israeli settler organization which claims it has ownership documents from the Ottoman Empire dating back to 1875. But the Palestinians say that those documents are completely forged. So in 1997, one of the Palestinian residents named Suleiman Hejazi, he produced the title deeds from the Ottoman archives proving his ownership over many plots of land, but the Israeli courts rejected that in 2005 because of that 1982 legal betrayal. And finally, in March 2009, the relevant Turkish record-keeping office, which has all of the Ottoman records, they wrote a letter that Hejazi produced in court, which basically stated that there are no Ottoman title deeds matching the claims of the Israeli settlers.
And obviously, but still, the Israelis did not even accept that, obviously. But Israel is right now trying so hard to erase Jerusalem's Palestinians. It has made colonial violence a permanent feature of native Palestinian lives in the holy city of Al-Quds Sharif. How do you think the scene will evolve in Al-Aqsa with more than 300 wounded now, and there are a lot of talk about certain martyrs that we've not heard about yet, and elsewhere also around Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank? How do you think this will maybe evolve as Israel prepares to build its first illegal colonial settlement in Al-Quds?
Well, this is clearly the beginning of another wave of attempted ethnic cleansing. So I think you can expect mass protests from the Palestinians, and the Israelis are slightly worried about this, which is probably why they've announced that they're going to delay the eviction. The conditions are ripe for mass protests because Israel is experiencing major political divisions, even among its majority settler population. Mm-hmm. There are protests against Netanyahu because he's on trial for corruption, which means that the conditions are really ripe for protests to be taking off in East Jerusalem against the Israeli occupation.
Well, it is frankly nauseating for me when I hear certain commentators in general, and specifically Palestinian ones from the authority, from the Palestinian Authority, who just like throw around all sorts of cliches like a cycle of violence, or they call for a return of calm, and generally engage in both sides are to be blamed, or there is no right and wrong side in that game. There are no two equal sides right now inside of all of occupied Palestine. What options do you think the Palestinians have to make sure that their authority fully understands and hears them?
Look, if the Palestinians on the ground feel like the Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas refuses to stand up for their legitimate national interests, then I suppose it would be in their interest to point out that the PA was not elected. There was an election in 2006 which Hamas won, regardless of what anyone thinks about them. Mm-hmm. Not only did Mahmoud Abbas refuse to step down, but his faction received military aid from Israel to fight off Hamas, which actually was elected to rule. So the PA has no democratic mandate to represent Palestine. So the question that remains for the Palestinians is whether they demand to be granted the same legal rights as Israeli citizens in the hopes of moving towards a one-state solution somehow, or whether they demand that the PA calls elections. But that's still kind of thinking in terms of the two-state solution. So they've got their backs to the apartheid wall. The Palestinians really are at the mercy of world public opinion, which explains why the Israelis have put so much effort into lobbying for big tech censorship all over the world so that the public is obstructed from seeing the truth of what's happening to Palestine. Back in 2016, Facebook began openly collaborating with Israel to shut down Palestinian voices inside the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And if we're to be perfectly honest, we can see the effects of that. I mean, I remember the outrage back in 2000 when I was very young, when Ariel Sharon visited the Al-Aqsa compound, and just that alone sparked the Second Intifada, and there were protests all over the world, and the Muslim world is very upset. Mm-hmm. But you look at that, you compare that today, over 300 Palestinians were injured after Israeli soldiers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which in the past used to offend Muslims all over the world. But mm-hmm. given the unprecedented level of big tech censorship in ways that favor Israel, it becomes increasingly obvious that Muslim YouTubers and content producers are giving far less attention to Palestine than they used to, and that's a major problem.
That's a very major problem, and I'm sure we should be looking into that furthermore. But I want to ask you about the election option. You said that Palestinians maybe should ask the authority, their Palestinian authority, for elections, but Israel's violence does not just stop at evictions, demolitions, and ethnic cleansing. Last week, they unequivocally indicated that it would not allow the Palestinians' legislative elections, originally scheduled for May 22nd, to be held in East Jerusalem, where we have more than 400,000 Palestinians living. How much more pushing and pressure do you think the Palestinian youth can take?
My impression is that since around 2006, the Palestinians of the West Bank, they've been spared the worst of the Israeli occupation, whereas Gaza's experience has actually experienced the worst. But what the kind of recent news shows is that even when Palestinians lay down their weapons, Israel will just keep grabbing more land. I mean, they're using that apartheid wall as an advancing front line to separate the northern part of the West Bank from the southern part. And so the problem for the Palestinians is that they're behind enemy lines. They have, the problem is that they, because they've got their backs to the wall, they're cut off from the rest of the West Bank, and therefore the old methods of armed resistance are far more difficult now than during the first two intifadas, which means that the only kind of effective forms of resistance that the Palestinians have left are political and diplomatic. Mm-hmm. But the problem here is that some countries are simply addicted to Palestinian victimhood, and that's because it serves their own selfish agendas. So, for example, Turkey and Qatar, they're going to use their media networks to support the protests, which of course is very important for Erdogan because he likes to present himself as the leader of the Muslims from time
but,
to time.
But it is not working out as they wish it would, especially right now in Al-Quds and in Al-Aqsa Mosque, as Israel closes it down in the face of the praying and the face of the prayers in Al-Quds Sharif. I want to thank you very much, Jay Tharathil, political writer and commentator, for joining us to talk about the plight
of the Palestinian people in the face of the Zionist occupation. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Yemenis from all walks of life took to the streets of Sana'a to mark the International Quds Day to express solidarity with Palestinians. The protesters raised Palestinian flags and chanted slogans in support of the Palestinian people and said any normalization of ties with the Israeli regime is a great betrayal. Meanwhile, the supply of aid to Yemen and the lifting of the blockade is still to be implemented, as it would save countless lives. Halting all Saudi bombardment campaigns and restricting the movement of Saudi-funded al-Qaeda extremists might be an effective start to end the humanitarian disaster in Yemen. More details in this foreign report.
Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of the capital Sana'a, as well as many other provinces such as Sada and Damar, in response to Imam Khomeini's everlasting call to commemorate the International Quds Day, which falls every year on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. The masses that poured in the Yemeni streets astonished Zionist Israel and its new Arab buddies. The sight of hundreds of thousands who are suffering from a human-made humanitarian crisis and still witness Saudi bombs falling on their heads, choosing to side by the Palestinian brothers, was just too much for the pro-Zionist camp to watch. This led the Saudi war machine on Friday to kill at least seven civilians after warplanes of the Saudi-led military coalition launched an airstrike on a group of people preparing for a pro-Palestine rally in Yemen's northern province of Ma'rib. The aerial aggression was carried out against Sahari village in Majzar district, where at least three other civilians were also wounded. Meanwhile, in Sana'a and other Yemeni provinces, participants raised slogans related to the occasion, flags of Yemen and Palestine, banners that denounced the Zionist occupation, as well as banners in protest against the U.S. policy in the region. In the same respect, leader of the Ansarullah revolutionary movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi, stressed in his Quds Day speech that the Yemeni people will continue unwaveringly in their adherence, supporting the Palestinian people to liberate Palestine, the holy sites, and the rest of the occupied Arab territories. Sayyid al-Houthi also renewed his calls for the Saudi regime to release the Palestinian detainees held in the kingdom's prisons in exchange of releasing Saudi servicemen held in Yemen. All the while, Yemen is witnessing the world's biggest humanitarian crisis. 24 million people, both citizens as well as refugees, need immediate assistance. Widespread famine has thousands in its grips. Another 2 million are on the edge of survival and perishing. With the COVID-19 pandemic also in full swing, conditions could not be direr in the country. Yet the world outside Yemen feel it is not necessary to engage with the crisis and the distress it is causing, simply because the Western regimes are making good money out of the Yemeni suffering.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Copenhagen is Rune Ayerhus, who's the chairman of the Yemen Solidarity Council. Thank you for being with us. Rune, now hundreds of thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of Sana'a, and hundreds of thousands also took to the streets of other governorates in Yemen to commemorate the International Al-Quds Day 2021 in support of the oppressed nation of Palestine, while they themselves are still suffering from Saudi bombardment, from Saudi blockade, all blessed by the U.S. imperial power. How do you reflect on such a scene from inside a war-torn country?
Well, I'm not exactly surprised at this huge gathering of solidarity by the Yemeni people towards the Palestinian cause, simply because the Yemeni people have always been the only people, if you so will, in the Arabian Peninsula that have always been supportive of the Palestinian people, even contrary to or contradicting, for example, the previous regimes of Ali Abdullah Saleh that tried to appease U.S. Interests and U.S. powers in the region, and also leaked documents a few months ago shows that the Saleh regime tried to work towards a normalization with the Zionist entity. But even despite that, the Yemeni people have always been on the side of the Palestinians, and it has become a larger sight to behold after the September 21st revolution back in 2014, where Sayyid Abdel Malik Bedreddin al-Houthi once stated that the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause in relation to the Yemeni revolution, is the guiding factor, it's the sole cause, it's the it's our primary cause in relation to the Yemeni revolution. So it's, I think it's remarkable that even despite all the suffering, all of the bombardments and the terror imposed on the Yemeni people, they still, to this day, valiantly put the Palestinian issue at mm-hmm. the forefront, even at the forefront of their own
Rin, we did see and hear that, as you just mentioned, by a leader of the Ansarullah revolutionary movement, Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi, who stressed in his Al-Quds Day speech that the issue of liberating Palestine will remain the Arab and the Muslims' first and central cause. This is his words. From one small group of resistance fighters in South Lebanon to a complete allied forces of resistance that just goes all across the region of West Asia, now threatening the existence of the Israeli apartheid entity, all the way to Yemen, going through Syria, Iraq, Palestine. What can Yemen offer their Palestinian brothers and sisters while they themselves are suffering?
Well, right now, as it is, they have the power and the skills to mobilize popular support for the Palestinian people, not only the Palestinian cause in itself, but in particular also the Palestinian armed struggle that has been ongoing ever since the Nakba of 1948. So they have that to deliver and to coordinate with the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. Who knows what will happen in the future? Perhaps if a war is imminent, or if a third intifada is right around the corner, I'm sure the Ansarullah would be able to at least coordinate maybe intelligence, considering also that the Israeli forces are cooperating with the Emirati forces, in particular in Socotra, the island of Socotra in the Gulf of Aden. They're building bases, intelligence operations on the island. So I think they'll be able to, you know, coordinate intelligence. But right now, what we are seeing is what they'll be able to offer the Palestinian people.
Well, the warfare has been escalating, particularly in the northern governorate of Ma'rib, where Saudi mercenaries are falling faster than expected, to be honest with you. What is the main goal for Mohammed bin Salman for keeping a hold, or desiring to keep a hold on Ma'rib, like it's the last thing he'll ever do?
Well, Ma'rib is the symbolically last stronghold of the exiled Hadi regime. It's where most of the government institutions are located, if not in Aden, of course. And it's also the city that is, of course, symbolically shows that, or paints a picture that the Hadi regime is in some ways a functioning state, but we all know that might or is not the case. it's symbolic, but it's also strategically important because it holds a lot of oil and a lot of gas that is meant to supply most of the entire country. And right now they have that under control. But if they lose that, they don't really have anything to bargain with. They can't cut off oil or gas supplies to Sana'a and the rest of the Western governorates. And they can't. They don't really have that bargaining chip to deal with. So by keeping a hold on Ma'rib as a last-ditch resort, and to send troops in that get killed almost instantly, and you know, to sacrifice so many people just to keep this city, it shows that it holds significant importance to both the Saudi coalition but also to the Hadi regime.
Well, we have more than 20 million between citizens and refugees who are in need of assistance in the face of the Saudi war machine and the Saudi blockade that is suffocating the people. Now, the humanitarian situation in Yemen is just falling off a cliff. What options do you think that the Yemenis have to at least take a step backward from the current inevitable cliff?
Well, I don't think the question is what options the Yemeni people have to do or to take a step back from falling off the cliff. I think the question is what can the international community do to not push the Yemeni people off the cliff? Because we all know that the...
Are they still alive? Do they really see what's going on in Yemen?
I don't know. They've been remarkably silent, all it took in Washington was a few activists, the hunger strike, to really get things going. But the international community needs to realize that the blockade on Yemen is what most of the Yemeni people are suffering from. The malnutrition, the lack of food and vital imports from Hodeida is all attributed to the Saudi-imposed siege and blockade on Yemen. It's not as much about what does the Yemeni people have to do. It's about the international community that has to realize that not only is the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2216 that it puts all blame on Ansarullah, it has flawed, and it has flawed for the past 6 years, but they also have to realize that the blockade is killing people, and it's not just about, you know, preventing arms to coming into Yemen and weapons and what have you. It's about, the blockade is actively blockading vital food and imports, and people are dying from it. They have to realize that it's a blockade.
Well, I'm going to thank you very much, Hun Ayahu's